The Bane Free Radio Hour.
All right, welcome to the Bane Free Radio Hour. Today we're talking with Jody Lynn Nye about her recent release, co-written with Eric Flint, one of the last, maybe the last, but if not, very close to the last book that we're putting out with any of Eric's work in it, The Weaver's Code. Jody Lynn Nye lists her main career activity as spoiling cats. When not engaged upon this worthy occupation, she writes fantasy and science fiction, most of it with a humorous bent. Since 1987, she has published over 50 books and more than 200 short stories. She has also written with notables in the industry, including Anne McCaffrey and Robert Asprin. Jody teaches writing seminars at SF conventions, including the two-day intensive workshop at Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia, and is coordinating judge for the Writers of the Future contest. Jody, welcome to the Radio Hour.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Oh, we're excited to have you. I've been a fan for a long time. Frankly, I know more of your books than I'm coming to know 1632 in the last couple of years as I've read a number of these. Why don't we start with a little background about 1632, in case anyone hasn't read any of them. We can sort of give enough background that somebody might want to pick up this book and start here.
People would want to read, I think, three of Eric's books, Eric's solo and collaborative books in the series. 1632 concerns a town called Grantville, which is swept up by persons or other forces unknown, and plopped down in the middle of 17th century Thuringia during the Hundred Years' War. And suffice it to say that whatever the Germans had going on, it's nothing compared to having a handful of Americans thrown into their midst. So things began to change immediately once they arrived, because they are not used to taking no for an answer, and they want things to go well for people. So it's quite an amazing series of books. Mine is number 37 in the series, and I'm proud to have been asked by Eric to participate in the series. It explores how the Americans start to impact history, the alliances they make, the changes they make, the innovations that they introduce. And some of them are apparent in each of the books as they have come out. So yeah. Mine picks up from the middle of, I think, 1634, and goes on from there. And I hope we'll go forward, since there's more story to tell. Yeah. It's extraordinary how many people Eric involved in this series.
Yeah, for sure. And kind of the legs that it's had. Bane's published a number of novels, but there have also been many volumes. I want to say 10 or 12 volumes of short stories published as the mm-hmm. Grantville Gazette. And I think probably many others basically just published online. It's interesting, right? It's as you get into the story, the world, I mean, initially there's like sort of a fish out of water story where we're a small town of West Virginia, right? But mm-hmm. mostly kind of a blue collar town. It's got a few kind of, you know, professionals, the high school principal or whatever. But how do we figure things out in, you know, in 17th century Germany? Right. But then they start to move out. And so you get the story kind of spills over into England, for example, but also into France and Italy and Turkey and India. And the world changes.
And the Americas.
Yeah. And the world changes in response. One of the sort of I don't want to describe it as a bit or a shtick, but like one of the sort of recurring ideas is people start to understand, oh, there's this new sort of political first force here, and yes. they are from the future. Like it's they say they are, and you know, they have books that talk about me, and they have advanced technology, and so we're creating a new future, right? And people, there's this sort of funny oddity where people in the 17th century can encounter an encyclopedia that describes a version of them that lived a very different life after a certain point, because suddenly, basically, there's this American force, right, that pushed everything, you know, depending on the story, slightly or dramatically askew. So your story starts, the Weaver's Code starts in 1634. Tell us about your main character. Who's your protagonist? What does she want? What are her problems?
The Honorable Miss Margaret de Beauchamp is the daughter of a baronet who owns properties in the north of England near Stoke-on-Trent. And she's come to London at the beginning of the story. This is the first part. At a time when the American embassy to the king is currently being held prisoner in the Tower of London. And the book around which this story is blended, at least at the beginning, shows them breaking free from the tower and escaping, because what was going to happen to them boded no good. And certainly, considering that the king was weak, the nobles were beginning to rebel, and there were a lot of things going on that were not good for them, they needed to get out. And without giving too much away, because for people who read this, this fills in some of the holes of how they got away.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, Margaret received recompense for her action. But it's not all roses, because for the king or his people to find out that Margaret's family was involved in their escape would be treason. So everything has to be kept very quiet, but they did her a favor that would save her family's fortunes, at least for that time. Her father is in the wool trade. He has many weavers working for him. He has many, many flocks of sheep. But at that time, the wool trade was dying in Great Britain. It was actually prospering on the continent. And because there were so many customers there, people were not willing to pay extra expenses for having their wool imported, their cloth goods imported. So naturally and unfortunately, Margaret had to go cap in hand back to the Americans and say, what can we do to possibly get your custom, despite the fact that perhaps we are not the best people for the job? But they are kindly disposed toward her because she did help them so much. And they're struggling to find a way when she comes across a new device that is being used in Magdeburg for bookkeeping, the aqualators, which are water computers. And she learns that they have a facility for calculating. Well, to set up a woolen pattern is a form of calculation, and she has seen what silk weavers can do on very, very complex looms with multiple shuttles and multiple wefts and against the warp, and wonders, if they can do it with silk, why can't we do it with wool? And she has come up with a new kind of cloth and needs a pattern for it. And that brings in our next person, who is a teenager named Aaron, and he is going to assist her in this. So we're introducing a new device that has to be kept secret from all, but you know what a leaky sieve a small town is. People have to talk. They just can't bear not to. So complexities arise from that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'm thinking about the history of the time, right? So the king is Charles I, and I'm trying to, in my head, sort of contextualize this. This is about the time the East India Company gets its charter and starts, isn't it? Early 1700s, and of course there's money.
Well, no, this is 1634. So the trade to India is actually coming early. All of these things are happening years, decades, even centuries ahead of when they would have evolved.
Yeah, sorry. I misspoke though. The year 1600 is in real history, the East India Company gets started. But one of the things that it prospers with is, so of course, I think spice is the thing that maybe is people think of dramatically, but also textiles. And in fact, a lot of the names for fabrics we have, like calico or muslin, come from fabrics that were basically bought up in the subcontinent and shipped back by East India Company employees. So it's fun. Your characters are sort of, and eventually, of course, the Industrial Revolution is the English textile industry, right? That then they say, well, we'll just make it here. We can be competitive with the foreign cloths that we've been bringing in if we get scale and we build machines. And so in a sense, your character is sort of cutting ahead 150, this is your point, cutting ahead 150 or 200 years to the industrial level, industrial revolution, which is a lot of fun. So the Aqualator, so tell me about this. This is a calculator that uses water.
It's very primitive because what it does is it's an analog computer of sorts, because what it the drops are led through a maze based upon the pattern of how quickly or how slow they want the drops to fall to trigger a movement, to trigger an action. And there's unfortunately kind of a black box involved here, because my tech person, Rick Boatwright, passed away before I could get more information from him. I miss Rick. I would rather do the, without the information and still have him with us.
Yeah.
So, but this this system seems to work in a manner that it it's driving the heddles of a loom based upon a pattern that is created within the aqualators, which are stacks of clay, hardened clay trays that the water flows. So it's slow, it's primitive, but it does work. And some of the kids, because children learn things faster than adults do, back in Magdeburg and in Grantville, which is the town that was swept up in the Ring of Fire, are working on trying to make themselves gaming computers, of course. But naturally, anything they make for themselves has other applications.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So the more complex and the faster they can go, the happier the kids will be.
I love that idea that it's a... it's an analog, it's a physical computer. So instead of the binary information, instead of being stored with an electron charge, is stored with like the presence of water or the absence of water, maybe.
Gate. It's little gates, because it's pretty much the way that you would, if A, then yes, if B, then no. It's all the way back to ones and zeros.
Yeah. So Margaret's obviously, she's a character who's she's got something in her, some ambition or a willingness to seize the opportunity, right? Because she does basically help the American escape. We know this from previous book, actually. Now we see more of it. But also, she sets out proactively to try to get basically the American technology, the uptimer technology. What are some of the risks and challenges to her in doing this?
Well, for one thing, the trays are fragile, so they do suffer some setbacks in not getting all of the ones shipped from Magdeburg to the United Kingdom. The resistance of the people involved, you know, the weavers don't want to do anything differently. The structure of the looms has not changed markedly since the Roman era, except that they have introduced foot pedals to make the heddles move. Weaving has been around a really, really long time, thousands of years, and the technology has not shifted all that much. So to introduce something like this that makes very complex patterns. It's not that they didn't exist, it's that they didn't exist in this form without quite as much human interaction, for one thing. That's a shift that they want to have. It's like saying to someone, well, you're going to open the door and then you're going to close the door. You're not going to do all the complex things that you used to because you don't have to. The machine will now do it for you. And people don't want to feel useless.
Yeah.
So there's resistance.
Yeah. There's also resistance in the way the guild has charged, fees, for example, right? The way things have been priced. People have their financial interests are threatened by someone who can come in and say, I can produce actually fairly complex work way faster and way cheaper. But I need to not have the guild stop me, and I need to have the other weavers consent, basically. And I don't want anyone to come in here and break my machines because they're, a fundamentally pretty fragile operation. So there's that whole side of it. There's also some sort of espionage. She's getting tailed as she heads to the continent to go try and get this machinery, right? There's like actual threats of physical violence against her.
Oh, yes. And it comes about because of a couple of spies who are working for the Earl of Cork, who is the king's chancellor. They stumble upon her by accident. They do. They are not by any means the sharpest knives in the drawer. But they're smart enough to realize that something strange is going on when an English girl in the middle of the war comes to the continent, which is not necessarily the safest place in the world. And they follow her. They're trying to report back on her, and she could be in real danger because they are reporting back. She does not want to draw attention because she asked the Earl of Cork for help in the beginning. He turned her down. So she had to find help somewhere, and obviously did. And the Earl of Cork is not a fool. So she's drawing attention to herself. She can't help but do that. And every move she makes, she can't help but be observed. So espionage is actually something that went on everywhere. And information is one of the most valuable commodities out there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, including commercial espionage. I read a book of maybe last year. It's depressing, but basically every major American ally, but I think in particular the author fingered, like the French and the Israelis and maybe the Japanese. In the second half of the 20th century, is part of getting ahead technologically was stealing what you could steal from American companies. So,
well, you don't want to be left behind in any way. So if there's something that's going on, one of the great commodities that is going around Grantville and the world of 1632 are the books from the Grantville libraries.
Yeah.
From the school libraries, from the public library, from the college library, textbooks and histories, biographies, all sorts of things. One of the reasons that King Charles I is in such a tizzy is he knows what's going to happen to him, at least in the old timeline.
Yeah, this is, yeah.
And he's scared.
Yeah, I dropped the punchline on that one. Yeah, exactly. Of all people, right? Some people look at themselves and go, huh, in this other universe, Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden, you probably feel good about yourself, but if you're Charles the First, you're probably pretty unhappy.
And yet he doesn't change his approach. In fact, he tightens his fist, which is foolish.
Yeah.
It's going to backfire on him. It's already backfiring.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's very true to human behavior, I think.
Human nature.
Yeah. So she goes to Magdeburg, and is that basically the Uptimers' capital at this point by 1630?
That is.
And so it's sitting at the sort of the network of a modernizing transport or in the center of like a modernizing transportation network. Like you have trains and you have tugboats and stuff
Nothing
approaching.
is finished yet, really.
Yeah.
It's transiting towards that way. And more to the point, the Americans are trying to introduce to intelligent driven people the idea that they will one day govern this too. It won't always just be the Americans. Mike Stearns, who is the president at this time that Margaret visits there, is not going to be president forever. It's going to fall into the hands of a German noble after a very short time. So the transition is already happening, and you hope that it's going to go well. They're guiding it in a way that it should go well, but things happen.
Yeah, that's an interesting sort of macro point in the series, right? Because you can't you show up with a small town worth of people. I don't know the numbers, but it's a few thousand, right? Something like that.
2,000, something like that. It's small.
It's small, and you've got a couple hundred years, 300 years technological jump, 400 years maybe, but that won't last, and it especially won't last. And I do love this portrayal in the Weaver's Code, but also in the series generally. The Americans like it's a very American portrayal of America in some ways. It's optimistic and it's upbeat, and we don't want to we don't see ourselves as wanting to dominate you. You know, we see ourselves as wanting to trade with you. And we are just as happy if you succeed. And you know, that is right. That is that's an interesting move because you're sort of investing in you're spending your technological advantage. It will go away, right? You will not be in charge. You won't be able to keep people down with your guns in 20 years, right? So you're betting you can win them over to your way of thinking or to your culture. Do you know, I mean, I have no idea. Do you know how far out this series is planned? Like, is there an end date?
I don't think there was. I don't think that Eric pictured it ending yet.
Yeah.
It would go to at least 1640. There's so much that people have not yet written.
Yeah.
This story has another half to it. There's
Yeah.
at least
Yeah.
there's so much that people want to say, and the as you say, the funny things about human nature that they begin to explore. 1632 has its own version of the tulip frenzy, one of the stories, Barbie dolls.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, there's quite a lot going on that is just little stories as well as the big stories.
All right. So, well, I'm interested in how much of the story is you, how much is Eric? What was that process like? How much involvement did he have in the end?
Well, Eric had so many irons in the fire that we discussed the idea initially. I have the notes literally written on a napkin from when the two of us sat down together, where we talked about it. We had another deep exchange at a terrible, terrible convention where it was so dead that you could literally have rolled a bowling ball down any aisle in the dealer's room and hit no one. And I had laryngitis, so I was typing texts out and Eric was answering me.
That's very funny.
But as for the actual writing of it, it devolved upon me
Pretty much
because
too.
we
Yeah.
lost him. And I had sent him the first major chunk, got some feedback from it, and then he said, "Well, I've got a deal. I have to talk to Chuck Gannon. I have to talk to Griffin Barber. I have to talk to various other people. I have this going on." And then there was no more time,
Yeah.
and my it breaks my heart because we were good friends. You
No.
know, we would see him and his wife Lou all the time. And I would very cheerfully rather have him back. But so I hope I have done him proud. His
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
and I have so many more notes that we were discussing about what would come next. And there are other books that are never going to be written because the co-authors have stepped away. So I just hope that we'll get a chance to tell the stories that we can.
Yeah.
You know, it is such a great series. It's uplifting. As you say, yes, American optimism. And some people will groan about that. We are the friendly shaggy dogs of the world.
Yeah.
People look at us and they say, yeah, they're not a brain in their heads and we don't want them on the furniture, but they are cheerful and friendly and
Right.
okay, but we're willing to give what we have because we want everybody to prosper if we can.
Yeah.
It's not just I got mine, so you're out of luck. It's I got mine, and here's how you can have yours too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because in
Yeah.
the end, I think that's more functional. I think that's more survivable.
It's I had this conversation with my father-in-law a few years ago. He said, you know, the problem with Americans is we never say you're welcome. Someone says thank you, we say thank you back. I said, well, yeah, but there's another way to see that, which is we instinctively don't feel like we're in a society of obligations. I'm helping you because you're also helping me. You know, I'm not obliged to you because you are the one on the higher tier, you know, bestowing benefits down upon me. We help each other. And so, yeah, it's a little weird. Thank you, but it sort of expresses kind of Americanism in that kind of heart, I think. So that sounds like, though, that you might have at least one more, maybe even two more stories. Would they be about, is that right? Would they be about Margaret?
Yes, yeah. I do not want to give away the ending, but on the very last page is her next idea.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
So.
yes, there's more to come that I have in mind for her. And there is so much that the Americans are doing, but they are inspiring other people to act as well. Whether
Yeah.
for good or for ill, they are taking American innovations and saying, we can do this with that. And whether or not that's a good thing, it isn't always. But some, I think that the most of it is because it's given so freely.
Yeah. Yeah, and as long as no one is coerced, right? Then people are both freely choosing to enter into a transaction. It should be because they're both benefited. It's the beauty of it.
One of the things that actually makes the weavers cooperate is to bring in another American innovation, profit sharing.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. That feels very Eric too. I like that.
And that was one of the things that Eric actually mentioned, which I had been keeping in my pocket until that moment.
Yeah.
So it was ready to come out and make things work.
Good. How good. I'm glad. Yeah, so this is mostly the Americans are mostly, in fact, I'm trying to remember, do we might have a little bit of their point of view, like what that there's a father and a son who come over to help set up in England, and I think we get some of their point of view there, but mostly it's Margaret or other downtime characters. And I love that. And I love also that it's an adventure about merchants rather than people who are trying to conquer, right? It's someone she's trying to save the family business. She's trying to save the industry that is struggling, right? She's trying to save the people, her competitors. And to some extent she has to because of kind of the guild structure. She can't just she's it's going to be rough if she tries to go it alone. But she tries to save everybody, even somewhat against their will. They have to be dragged
Yes.
to it.
I think this may be, I think I was told that this is the first of the mainline series that is from the point of view from a downtimer.
Oh, cool. That's very cool. Well, fantastic. Well, what have we not said about the Weaver's Code that you think a reader might want to know?
Oh, I think it evolves fairly organically that Margaret has to steel herself to ask favors, which is hard for anybody, but she does it because she wants to save her family, her father's pride, but also all the people who are depending upon her. And that's something that a good, if let's call it a feudal lord, would have done, is that the people who worked for them had to be taken in mind. You always see people swearing allegiance to a liege lord in a movie, but what you don't hear is the other half of that oath. You swear fealty to this person, but there's a second half to it, and that is the lord swearing to uphold and care for the people who are swearing allegiance to him. There's an obligation both ways, and that existed in the past. That existed then. So it's something that I think should not be forgotten.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thought, and it's something so she replicates that, maybe not consciously, maybe just instinctively, maybe it's just the way she sees the world, in a but she replicates that in a business, right? In a commercial venture. And there's no reason, man. I read this History of Russia. It's not Orlando Figgs, I think, was the author, and he was talking about Russian commerce, and he made a distinction between the way commerce evolved in the Netherlands and England, and the way it evolved in Russia. And I'm going to say this, and maybe some Russians are going to hate me, but his distinction was very similar to what you're saying. In the Netherlands and then England, there was this idea that, okay, you went out and you competed and you were trying to win. And when you won, you then gave back to the community. So that's great. You're rich, Meneer, Reichert, you're the one who's going to endow the library. You're going to pay for the stained glass windows in the church, right? You're going to pave the town hall, the town square, whatever, right? He said in Russian commerce, the goal was there was never any idea of fair rules. The goal was a fair play or rules. The goal was just to rip off the other guy. The more you ripped him off, the better you were, and you laughed all the way to the bank, and you never had to share anything. Now, I don't know how true that is, but it's interesting to see her kind of play by that model, right? And to think about. And that feels like Eric would have something. This would be a conversation Eric might be happy to be in, right? Is, hey, when people succeed, they should be. It's good to have a culture that encourages the successful to share and to care for others.
You can tell so much about Eric's point of view from these books because we carried that forward, and he was careful to say to people, this is how I want to see this happen, that trade unions exist and that protection for the masses exists. He was a socialist. He was open about that. He had been a rabble-rouser for the unions, and that served a purpose. Because no matter how important the president of a company was, he's nothing without the people who work for him. And without their support, there's no business.
And I think Eric was my sense, you tell me. I think he liked small business people. I think he was maybe less favorable of enormous mega corporations, but I think he was himself a small business person, right? And actually, that's interesting. He gave a lot of writers in science fiction and fantasy an opportunity to get published who otherwise might not have found an open door, right? So in a sense, this is an idea we're talking about, an idea that Eric practiced as well as wrote about.
I know more than one person. Eric bought their first story. Their first professional sale was to the Grantville Gazette. So a lot of people owe their careers to him.
Yeah, and I think more than one writer has basically gotten in their way into Bain writing novels, because they sort of did work with Eric and co-wrote with Eric and published shorts with him first, and then that was, I think, part of Chuck's story, for example. So Eric, thank you.
Absolutely. There's got to be at least 60, probably more, people who would not have had professional sales without him.
Yeah.
And he put in his commentary, he would always tell them, okay, this doesn't work for this reason. And he had it in his mind for his timeline so far ahead that he could say, no, no, this is going to change here. You can't use this because. And he didn't, he was careful about what kind of themes that he allowed. Such as no magic, no impossible elements to it, only possibly highly improbable. So he set the guidelines for this world, and a lot of people responded to it. They also responded to the good-hearted quality of the fiction, but also the adventure. And involving historical figures is very appealing to so many readers. I was fascinated to see what he did, for example, in the story that involves Cardinal Richelieu.
Oh yeah.
And he is a notorious villain for anyone who read the Three Musketeers.
Yeah.
But he was, at that time, he was France.
Yeah.
He protected France. And that doesn't make him a villain in history.
Right.
So how does he appear in 1632? As a wily, intelligent, calculating person who had his eye on what he intended to achieve all the time. Fascinating character. And he's very much three-dimensional in 1632.
Yeah. Yeah. And in those, in fact, I just read Walter's follow-up to that. Sunday, I just read that.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah. So it's on this specific point, the fun of involving historical figures, there's that fun is reflected sort of in an ironic kind of mirror image in those novels, because one of the things that becomes very popular in France is Dumas' novels, which depict basically modern day, right? Like here's the future. A Frenchman wrote novels about now, except we're not going to end up in the future where that guy was a novelist. We're going somewhere else. But so you have characters talking about how they are portrayed by Dumas. There's one guy who's got a chip on his shoulder. He's annoyed that Dumas did not include him.
It's like the Muppet movies. Everybody wants a cameo.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Well, Jody, fantastic. Thank you. So other, maybe a sequel for Margaret, but what are you working on in the meantime? What will we see next?
I'm working on, as you know, Robert Asprin wrote the Myth Adventure series, and he and I wrote several books after his initial 12-book contract was finished. And after he passed away, I have taken it over. I've published two books in the series. I'm working on a third, and I want it finished by the end of the year. And I have a couple other projects that I'm working on. I don't know if I'm at liberty to talk about one of them, but the other is a new fantasy series that I've got in mind, and a science fiction story that started out as kind of a lark and has taken a very serious turn. It's about first contact and family relations and loneliness.
Fantastic. Well, Jody, I'm looking forward very much to seeing all of those. Once again, man, I realize I got the beginning slightly wrong. I did not say the book is 1635, The Weaver's Code, out now in hardcover. There it is. Very beautiful. Also, ebooks, wherever books are sold. DRM free if you buy the ebooks at bain.com, as always. Jody, Lynn, and I, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you so much for having me.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near-future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the Elven Court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
Riki helped her support Pony on the long walk to her bedroom through dusty warehouses and barren offices. The Sakasha concentrated on putting one foot in front of the other, only flinches of pain on his face showing how badly he was hurt. Tinker wanted to scream accusations at Riki, but Chiyo's punishment was still stark in her mind. Even the Kitsune thought that the breeding had been considered the kindest of the possible punishments.
"I'm sorry," Riki said as he delivered them to the bedroom that proved, without Chiyo's presence, to be windowless.
"Why?" He took her to mean why Pony, although she wasn't sure herself which of the many whys she meant. Why did he continue serving such a monster? Why had he kept her silent, thus and in hindsight safe from Tom Tom's anger? Why hadn't he chosen one of the many humans she loved?
"I find that I actually think of myself as human, more than I thought," Riki said. "It was easier to pick an elf. I was taught to hate them."
"I'm an elf."
"You'll always be a human to me."
Only humans said things like that, so maybe he was telling the truth. Still, she couldn't find any room to forgive him. "Go away," she said, and shut the door on his face. She wanted to press Pony for details about what Windwolf was doing, how Oil Can was coping with her supposed death, if work had continued on her research center, but Pony looked like hell. She cleaned the blood from Pony's face and nearly cried over the heel print bruised into the back of his right hand, his fingers swollen and broken.
"It is nothing," he mumbled. "I heal quickly. I will be better in no time."
Unfortunately, until he was functioning better, there would be no escaping. She fingered where the power beads had been worked into his hair. The Oni had cut his braids off, leaving little tufts of hair. Spellmarked or not, without the stored magical power, Pony's shields would quickly fail. The Oni's ability to create permanent constructs, like Riki's wings and the Foo Dogs, outclassed the elves' magic that normally required a ley line, or it exhausted local ambient magic. Pony took the lack of weapons and shields personally.
"I'm sorry that I have failed you."
"Don't be an idiot. You haven't failed me." And then, because he didn't seem to believe her, she added truthfully, "I'm glad not to be all alone."
"Ah, I see. Then I'm glad to be here."
She couldn't bring herself to scorn him, despite it being silly for him to be happy to be stuck in such a situation. "What are you doing?" Pony had started to stretch cautiously out on the floor.
"I am going to sleep."
"Oh, get in the bed."
"You should sleep in the bed. I can sleep on the floor."
"Don't make me hit you." Tinker pushed him toward the bed. "The bed is huge, and I'm quite small, as everyone keeps pointing out. We can both share it without even noticing the other is in it."
"It wouldn't be proper."
"Get in the bed or I'll sleep on the floor too." He actually agonized over it before giving in.
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker. And that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.